Today's episode of Real Talk with Zuby is brought to you by our sponsors, OZ Lifestyle Brands. OZ Lifestyle Brands care a lot about the details. Their selection of men's accessories balance style with substance and quality and craftsmanship, showcasing both casual and classic designs. They also make shopping really easy for you. You can just go check out their website, ozlifestylebrands.com. They've got a fantastic selection of watches, wallets, t-shirts, and other accessories, especially designed for men with ultra-discerning tastes. OZ is for men who have found their calling but don't feel the need to shout about it. So I recommend you go check out their full range of products over at ozlifestylebrands.com. To let them know that I sent you and to get 20% off your entire first order, just use the code ZUBYMUSIC at checkout. That is ZUBYMUSIC, Z-U-B-Y music, at checkout to get 20% off your entire order at ozlifestylebrands.com. ozlifestylebrands.com. Go check them out. Sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram. Stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam. Put some respect on my name. Sick like Obain, click and I bang. Y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name. What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we've got on a very fascinating guest with a very brilliant and interesting mind. This is evolutionary biologist Colin Wright. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Zuby. Appreciate
You're most welcome, man. How's everything going? You good?
Everything's going pretty well so far. Just in job application season, submitting maybe about 20 jobs so far, and I got at least that many to go until the year's over. So
getting crazy. Okay. What kind of stuff are you looking for? What kind of work does an evolutionary biologist do these days?
Yeah, so I mean, I study social behavior in ants, wasps, and social spiders. So I'm basically applying to any type of postdoctoral position or some sort of tenure track position somewhere, or even just teaching only jobs at universities or I guess sort of a liberal arts college type place. Basically, when you're in academia, you don't get to choose where you work. There's so many jobs that go on the market, and you get about 500 applications for each job. And so if you were to get an offer somewhere, you basically just take it. So we'll see. I could be anywhere in the world next year.
Okay. So tell us a little bit more about your work and what you specialize in then.
Yeah. So I study, I guess I'm more specifically, I'm a evolutionary behavioral ecologist. So I study animal personalities. So it's kind of what you might expect. So personality is just consistent differences between individuals and the way that they behave over time. And so I study this in animals, and more specifically in like social insects or arachnids. So just like, you know, you have dogs and cats, you know that no two dog behaves the same way. Same with humans. No two human behaves the same way. They might be more aggressive or more docile or more sociable or more kind of, you know, isolated. And not just our pets and humans have these traits. It's also a trait of wild animals, too. And so basically I'll be looking at like a big colony of spiders or wasps or ants. And I'll quantify the personality distribution like within these colonies, like how similarly do all the individuals behave compared to one another. And then I use these individual differences in their behavior to look at how these produce sort of colony level behaviors, collective behaviors, and how that relates to outcomes like survival and building their nests and capturing prey and things like that.
Okay. That's very, very specific. So I've got two questions, so I'll start with the first one off the bat, which is, how did you get into this?
Yeah, so I've always been one of those kids that was interested in sort of messing with ants in my backyard. You know, I wasn't very kind to them as a kid, but as I grew older, it became more of just like an intellectual fascination. I read a lot of E.O. Wilson and other people that were just, you know, talking about the social insects and how they behave.
You weren't using a magnifying glass on them, were you?
Yeah, I was definitely. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
There was this fence in my backyard, and there was like these black ants on the top, and then there was a line of these red ants that were going, and I would just like put a stick between there, and then just like they would connect, and I would just watch like the carnage. And in a way, I still do similar stuff. I mean, I'll do experiments in South Africa where I'm looking at how the ants are preying upon the social spider colonies, and so it's basically just sort of like this. These Lord of the Rings battles between spiders and ants, and it's pretty brutal, but it's pretty fun to watch.
Yeah, no, I remember
I don't think I ever really did it myself, but I do certainly remember growing up in the Middle East in Saudi Arabia, obviously, where you've got super intensely hot sun. And so people would do the thing with the magnifying glass where you concentrate, where you concentrate the thing. And yeah, that would, people used to just sort of set these insects and stuff on fire, which was probably a little bit mean in hindsight, but boys, I guess.
All done that. All been there. Yeah. So that was my sort of early fascination. And then as I got to undergrad, I knew I wanted to study evolution, but I wasn't sure. I was kind of leaning towards maybe I get into paleo. Maybe I'll go into sort of a molecular evolution type thing. And then I took an animal behavior class, and that just sealed the deal for me because it was the most fascinating class I've ever taken. Just the way you can quantify animal behaviors and look at how behaviors evolve over time and the selection pressures that shape different behaviors. And then social behavior was just like the most complex and intricate of all the behaviors you have. And so just the way that these colonies are able to orchestrate and divide labor up among sometimes millions of individuals, it just blew me away. And so I realized that's something I wanted to study. And I never thought I'd get into studying social spiders. But when I was Googling professional special places where I might go to grad school, this just sort of came up on, you know, a few pages back on the Google search. Someone was looking for a graduate student, and they specifically studied social spiders. So I sent an application, and I got it. And it's been history.
When I think of spiders, I don't really think of them being social animals. Like when you talk about ants, wasps, bees, obviously I know they're in, you know, they have hives, colonies, and they kind of do their thing in that regard. But I always think of spiders as being quite solitary creatures.
Most spiders, so you'll look at the orb weavers, they're just sitting in the middle of their web, they're by themselves. Almost the only social interactions most spiders have is when they're immediately born and they have a bunch of offspring around them, or when they're in a mating context where they need to at least interact with one other spider of opposite sex, but that usually doesn't turn out well. Like sometimes they'll either mate nicely, or the male will get cannibalized before they even mate sometimes. But only maybe I think 25 to 30 species of spider.
How's that for male privilege? Sorry.
Yeah. So there's thousands of species of spiders, but only about 25 to 30 are social in any long period of time. So the ones that I study, there's a few social species that are in sort of the Southern Africa region. And those are the ones I study. There's also some in the US and all around the world as well. But they're pretty neat. They're not like ants, bees, and wasps in the sense that social spiders don't have a queen. So they're all basically, I don't want to say they're all equals because there are some individuals that are more influential than others, but they're more or less the same body type, and they cooperate on all sorts of behaviors in their colonies.
Yeah. How do you actually study that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So you want to pick behaviors that are really sort of easy to record. So when we study, you know, if you study like human personality, like a lot of psychologists do, you know, you can give people a survey, you can have them fill out a form, and you can get an idea of their personalities. But with animals, since they can't fill out surveys, you can't ask them things, you have to look at things that are sort of more obvious. So you might put them in a situation that they've never been in, where they have to interact with sort of like a novel object in their environment. And this is sort of a measurement of what's called neophobia or boldness. So it's like the propensity of an individual to sort of engage in a risky behavior. And if there's a new object in their environment they've never seen before, you know, if they're active around it, or if they're investigating it readily, you know, they're more risk prone than if you have some individual that maybe like shies away from this thing and won't even go near it. So we can measure things like boldness, of how long does it take for them to interact with a certain novel object or to enter a new environment, basically. Mm-hmm. You can look at things like exploration, how thoroughly do they explore their environments.
Is this done in the natural habitat, or is this in a sort of lab setting?
It can be done in both. Okay. Yeah. Usually I do them in the lab setting. I have done them both in the lab and field.
Okay.
And then things like aggressiveness that are pretty straightforward to measure. Like you can quantify, you know, if I'm going to, you know, antagonize this individual 10 times, and I'm going to see how many times they try to attack the prod back or something. And so you do this more than once. You'll do that maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 times. And then you can sort of get an idea of how consistent they are across different trials and their personalities, and then how different they are compared to others in whatever trait you're trying to measure.
Okay. And then my next big question I was going to ask is, what's the point of it? I mean, what's the goal to, like, what do you want to glean, not just you specifically, but the wider field of study by looking into the behaviors of whether it's ants or wasps or social spiders? What are the goals, I guess, of that field of study?
So a lot of it is constructing sort of models of what's possible biologically, given different personality distributions. So we've had labs where we've been trying to make machines be able to learn which individuals are most influential, say, in like a group context based on their personalities, and then get computers to be able to predict, which individual is the most influential by showing them sort of repeated trials of these behaviors that we're doing. Mm-hmm. And so right now it's sort of constructing models of what's possible, but there's ideas that you could look at, for instance, in certain like riot scenarios where you have a bunch of individuals that are rioting in a street, and you'll have some individuals that are going to be more influential or being like more leaders than others. And could you create some kind of computer learning that's able to sort of identify these specific behaviors of individuals that you know it might not be able to see by like standing back and looking at a crowd, mm-hmm. but a computer trained in knowing what to look for, could it identify those influential individuals? And also in
why does this scare me?
It could. I mean,
I'm not a rioter.
My previous lab had a grant for the Department of Defense that was sort of along those lines.
Okay.
But in general, it's sort of an exploratory look at what's possible given different personality distributions. We have it's being used in human psychology as well. So in corporate America, when you're trying to build certain teams to achieve a certain goal. You know, you don't want a whole team that's full of a bunch of really aggressive hotheads. There actually turns out to be that there's an optimal sort of mix of personality types that you'd want in a certain setting that will actually achieve a better, more efficient goal than if you had sort of a one group that's completely homogenous with a certain type of behavior. So it's useful in human context as well. In an ecological context, what I study in, it's looking how an organism is going to be able to survive, how it might, how climate change might affect the distribution of these animals, what personalities and collective behaviors are being selected in different environments, and how might climate change affect that or something. So there's all kinds of spin-off related science that can relate to it.
And how relevant or how similar are different species in this regard? So can you look at ants and wasps and spiders and humans and rats and elephants, and are there very common patterns amongst them?
There are. So one big pattern that we tend to see emerge in labs is that aggressiveness looks like it does really, really well in laboratory settings, and then sometimes in short-term settings in the field too. Really aggressive colonies of spiders, for instance, tend to really dominate all those around them. They're really good at defending their colonies, and they're good at catching prey, for instance. Mm-hmm. But usually there seems to be this big trade-off between being a really aggressive and then more long-term goals. So for instance, you can have a really aggressive spider colony, and it might kick butt, capturing prey and defending their colony, but they're so aggressive that their aggression sort of spills over in other contexts where it's not good to be aggressive, like mm-hmm. trying to rear offspring. We tend to see these spiders that are more, if you're an aggressive spider, you're more likely to cannibalize your young, for instance. Mm-hmm. Or if you're a really aggressive ant, you're really active. It's really good for bringing in lots of food, but on really hot days, these aggressive colonies tend not to be able to rein in how aggressive they are. And so they'll have too many workers outside when it's really hot that increases the mortality of all their foragers, basically. So there's definitely like a context specific trade-off you see between a lot of different behaviors. Okay. And that seems to be a pretty common signal within a lot of systems. But there's also issues of, if I test boldness or aggressive in an ant, how comparable is that to testing aggressiveness in a bird or something like that? Are this not even the same neural pathways? So it's just sort of these coarse looks at these certain types of behaviors.
Yeah. Is there anything that's, what's the thing that's blown your mind most since you've been studying this?
Yeah. So we have, so in my, the spiders that I study, they're, so these South African desert spiders, Stegodypus demiccola, that's their genus and species. They have what's known as keystone individuals in this group. Mm-hmm. So a keystone individual is just certain, a certain individual that has a disproportionate influence on group dynamics, relative to how abundant these individuals are within a group. So, like a queen of an ant colony, that's a highly influential individual that's, you know, has more influence than just any single worker. Mm-hmm. And in my spider colonies, you can have these single, really highly bold individuals, these risk-prone spiders. And if you have a whole colony of really risk-averse spiders, they're just like the shyest spiders, is what we call them. If you add just a single, really bold individual to the group, it will increase the overall group boldness by 400%. They'll attack prey much faster. There's like this leader-follower dynamic in some of these populations where you can just put this influential spider in there, and they're like these trend-setting spiders, and they just, people, but these other spiders, they'll just sort of follow their lead. And so we're looking at how this has evolved and what context might this not do well. And, you know, there's trade-offs where if you train like one of the keystones to respond to stimuli that are maybe it's like bad information, and you put them in a colony, well, then the colony is going to rely on this individual that's basically been given false information about the nature of reality. And those colonies tend to not do well. So we can manipulate the keystones, and then that just manipulating one individual can manipulate the behavior of the entire group.
Okay. And this definitely leads into human psychology for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. We always look at, every time we talk about bold spiders being highly influential, we always look at like Donald Trump. He's like a bold spider. Look what he's doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I recently read not an article, but there was a thread you sent me on Twitter about the what you call the univariate fallacy, which is something that you've noticed both in academia and outside of it. So can you explain to our listeners what that's all about and how you've seen that manifest, what it is, what the downfalls are, and how to address it?
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen some of the similar rhetoric given that you've interacted with trans activists to some degree by doing your deadlift and all that stuff. And we tend to see,
they all block me.
Yeah, they block me too. Okay. But you'll tend to hear that biological sex is a spectrum. Like that's something you might have heard from these activists, or that, you know, there's sex isn't binary. That might be the Trojan horse. They'll say, like, you know, sex isn't binary. There's some articles you can see in things like Scientific American will say, you know, there's up to like 9 sexes, and they'll be categorizing sexes based on just like different chromosomal arrangements or something. But I mean, the take home is that you'll hear a lot of people say sex is a spectrum, that there's not just male and female, but there's just like this broad spectrum in between, and there's nothing that's really defining of a male or female in essence. Like there's no single factor that you can just drill down on that will unassailably categorize this individual as being male or this individual as being female. You know, you'll
penis.
See, like, exactly. You'll say, do you have a penis? And they'll just be like, well, is that the only thing? Because some of these individuals can have like enlarged, you know, an enlarged clitoris or something. Or, you know, in the case of Castor Semenya, they'll say that, you know, this is a female, even though they have XY chromosomes. They're genetically male, but since they have a vagina, they'll say that it's, you know, they'll want to classify her as being female, and because they'll say that, you know, the vagina maybe is the one thing that trumps everything else. And so the fallacy, basically, the univariate fallacy is this claim that if you cannot distill any differences between these proposed groups down to a single factor, that these groups are then social constructs or don't represent natural categories in nature. So it's hard to say, like, is it just chromosomes that determine sex? Because you can have XX individuals that still have this male determining gene on their one of their X chromosomes, well, they look completely male. Or you could have XY individuals who aren't sensitive to androgens, and they look exactly like any female would. So they'll basically just try to debunk every single little mechanism to try to just like say that these categories don't exist.
So basically take very rare exceptions and outliers and try to use that to disprove the general rule.
Yes. Yeah. So in reality, when you look at just sort of, you know, at birth, about 99.98% and more of individuals are just unambiguously male or female. They can be placed into these separate categories. There are certain, you know, less than 0.02% of the population that will fall into this, you know, this gray area that's, you know, a phenotypic gray area. So these so-called intersex individuals. Mm-hmm. But all these individuals, a big misconception about these intersex categories is that intersex people are maybe like a third sex, or that they don't have a biological sex. When in reality, intersex conditions are sex-specific conditions. So even if you're intersex, you still have a biological sex. It's just might be ambiguous, or there might be a mismatch between your genetic sex and the way you appear. Mm-hmm. So the univariate fallacy it's used not just in trying to debunk sort of the sex binary in humans, but you also see it in places like people trying to say that there's no differences between males and females in personality or in the way our brains are structured. Mm. And, you know, if you were to look at any single variable, like how much white matter do these brains have or something, or how aggressive are you? You know, you might be able to say, like, you know, if you're just looking at someone and you're going to say, I want to try to predict someone's sex just by knowing how aggressive a person is, you know, you're not going to be able to be that, you know, that high of precision. You might guess maybe 70% of the time or something. Mm-hmm. But if you were to then use something like, well, I want to know how aggressive they are, I want to know how agreeable they are, and if you go down the whole big five personality tests, then what you'll see is that you can actually create models that can predict an individual's sex, you know, 95% or more just on a survey. And that's because the differences aren't on any single axis, like sociability or how agreeable you are, but it's how that these traits are correlated with other traits that you have. So there's sort of these suites of correlated traits or sort of behavioral or personality syndromes that will classify these two distributions of male or female.
Real Talk with Zuby is sponsored by Gumroad.com. Gumroad is a platform that makes it really, really easy for creators of all kinds to sell their products, both digital and physical. It's what I've been using for my latest book, Strong Advice, Zuby's Guide to Fitness for Everybody. Gumroad makes it really quick, seamless, intuitive, and easy to sell whatever it is that you want. You can get started in just a few minutes by going to gumroad.com, signing up as a creator, and setting up your product. Did I mention that it's free to use? It makes it really quick and easy for you to set up and sell your products and get paid every single week, and it also makes it really easy for buyers to pay you with credit card, debit card, PayPal, various payment methods. It works well on mobile as well as on desktop. So I highly recommend you go check them out, whether you are an artist, a podcaster, a creator, a musician, whatever it is that you do, check out gumroad.com. That is GUMROAD.com, and get started today. Gumroad.com.
So those are probably the main places that you'll see the univariate fallacy being said. So you'll see people like Cordelia Fine or something will say that, you know, it's because, you know, they can point to a female that's really aggressive or more aggressive than most men. Then all of a sudden, there's nothing, you can't make any claims about aggressiveness related to sex or something like that. You know, just because you can find an outlier in one dimension doesn't mean that you can't correlate these all and make a highly predictive model that can predict.
And obviously, with any of those traits, once you go to the extreme ends on them, you get massive clustering of, you know, if you go all the way to the end of the, okay, let's just look at the 5% of most aggressive people. You're going to get, I don't know, 95% of them are going to be male. If you look at the bottom 5% of aggressive people, or the top 5% of most agreeable people, or the top 5% of most neurotic people, you're going to end up with almost all women, just because of the way, you know, the way the bell curves sort of line up. Yeah. I've got a couple of questions. I mean, the first one is, why has this become a thing recently? Right? Like, what's the agenda here? What do you think? I mean, what's the goal? Why are people suddenly, I mean, it seems pretty sudden. I mean, 10 years ago, if you said there's two sexes or two genders, everyone would be like, yeah, duh. You know, even 7 years ago. But it seems like in the past 5 years, we're suddenly, well, in the Western world anyway, not everywhere else, people are suddenly questioning and challenging this idea of men and women. I mean, it's weird to me because lots of these things cancel out. So people are saying there's no difference between a male brain and a female brain, mm-hmm. but men and women are different, but they're the same and you can switch between them. And I'm like, wait, which ones of these are you saying are true? Because not all like this, what you're saying isn't making sense here, right? Because yeah. you're saying that, I don't know, gender is what you feel, but then men have these advantages that women don't, or women have these advantages that men don't. But those same people can't define the word man and the man and the word woman, right? To me, this is almost like the most basic thing. Like there are certain things in life that are just self-evident. I find it almost weird that I'm here, you know, if I'm seeing some of these conversations online and I'm seeing evolutionary biologists and evolutionary psychologists and, you know, all these high-powered brains, you know, having to throw all this academia and studies and whatnot to explain something that my 2-year-old nephew understands. You see what I mean? Like it just strikes me as weird because people are throwing out all this stuff and I'm just like, I don't know. I feel like there are some things that are almost so self-evident that I don't know if I can prove that your t-shirt is a dark red, right? But I can just see it is. If someone was like, oh, well, what's your proof? Maybe there's something I could use, some sort of tool I can use to prove, but I'd just be like, well, it just is, just like your...
Don't you know that color red is a social construct? Like I've had people...
That's the thing. It's like, I don't know how far people want to go, but but coming back to the question, I mean, what do you think the goal is here?
Yeah, so I've sent out tweets before that said that, you know, because I want to be a professor, that's my goal, that's what I'm applying to. And, you know, when I'm teaching a class, you know, I'll be teaching people about genetics and, you know, about my field of behavioral ecology and just like I'll be teaching people about the frontier of, you know, ant colony dynamics and what we know about social behavior and ecology and community dynamics and all this stuff. And it just seems so bizarre that, like, this is what they want me to teach in university. But at the same time, I'll know that a healthy subset of people in my class will somehow be unaware of the existence of males and females as discrete categories. So it's just like, I find myself going back to having like these birds and the bees talks with adults, sometimes in their 40s or later, who seem to just not know this basic fact about, you know, the biology that you think you just pick up just by having two eyes and a functioning brain, that males and females exist.
But do they really not know, or are they almost acting like they don't know? Because one of the weirdest things I find with this whole thing is that it seems like this really strange cognitive dissonance where on a day-to-day basis, I mean, for example, if we're going to talk about the idea of assuming somebody's gender, everybody assumes people's gender all the time, right? An outsider, even someone who's really into this ideology, would see us two having this conversation and go, that's two men talking. You see what I mean, right? And they'd automatically refer to, Zuby said this, he said this, right? And then they'll go away and they'll say, oh, you need to ask people's pronouns and you can't make these assumptions. And it's like every single day, just by default, we're all, I mean, you walk down the street, man, woman, woman, man, woman. Like everybody does that. It's such a basic thing. So I find it weird that people are saying, oh, you can't tell the difference, or there's no difference, or it's not a binary thing. But in real life, everybody does actually treat it as a binary. And so that's how people hear everything.
Yeah, the vast majority of people, when they say that, you know, they're looking at us and they say these are two men talking, what they mean by the word man is adult human male. Yeah. And that's the sex is usually baked into that whole what it means to be a man. It's only recently how it's been changed, where man no longer reflects adult human male, and now it reflects just sort of this like innate sense of maleness, which is itself meaningless because maleness can then be anything, or, you know, manliness or masculinity. you know, just it ultimately boils down to just like masculine stereotypes at that point. And so that's this other thing. You asked initially about, you know, where did this, how did this whole ideology come from and start, and this people willing to just like blow up these binaries? I think a lot of it's just sort of misplaced empathy or this drive for wanting equality, but their approach is just like completely backwards. So they, in the sense that they want everyone to be equal, and rather than saying that, you know, embrace everyone's the diversity that we see among everybody, not everyone's going to have the same abilities. You know, some people are going to be more intelligent, less intelligent. Some people are going to be more physically attractive, less. Rather than just like a commitment to treating everyone the same and giving them, you know, universal human rights and dignity, instead they sort of invert that, and they say that they try to get rid of any physical differences, or they try to deny that any differences exist to make everyone equal. So they try to just deny reality so that everyone is the same.
But then they promote. Yeah. But then those same people say they want diversity, right?
That they want to embrace diversity. Yeah. So it's, it really doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Because in a way they're saying that like, there's this assumption that they're making that, well, if these differences were real, then there would be a basis for discrimination. Mm. When that's not the route we want to go. Like, we don't want discrimination to be based on finding actual real differences. We want to say like, no, in a society where we respect the dignity and human rights of everyone, people can be different and they shouldn't be treated differently. There, everyone should have the same rights, mm-hmm. and that, you know, discrimination shouldn't be based on the differences that we find. So in a way, their worldview, I think, is the most dangerous, because it's capable of just being, well, blown apart by any finding within the sciences that do show differences exist. That's why when you get somebody studying human personality or intelligence researchers or something, and they'll find, you know, some disparity between groups on anything, they want to say that that's complete socialization, or they'll say, you know, this is nothing but sexism. But even though, like, we can say that these differences exist, yeah. and that doesn't mean I'm a sexist, you know, like, I will say that males are more aggressive than females. I don't know how good a thing that is. Like, is it good that males, you know, commit 95% of all the homicides? Yeah. Like,
I mean, I often say that to a large degree, the reason why so many men start companies in proportion to women or rise to certain ranks within companies or organizations is largely the same reason why the vast majority of people in prison are men. It's the same dimension. For the most part, it's the same traits. It just depends on how they're honed and how they're harnessed, right? It can be in a very, you can channel aggression in an extremely positive way. Aggression and competition can be great, but they can also be very, very destructive, especially if you couple them with, you know, any sort of sociopathic tendencies or someone who just wants to commit evil. But I don't know. It's very much the same thing. Yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things I've been sort of mulling over quite a lot for the past couple of years, especially as things just get weirder and weirder and weirder. I'm just kind of, you know, it's getting harder to tell what's real and what's a parody even, right? I'll see something on Twitter. I'll be like, is this someone trolling or is this what someone really believes?
I've mentioned before that I've never simultaneously felt like more sane and also like I might be losing my mind. Like, it's a weird feeling where I feel both to the maximum degree at the same time. It's just like I feel insane because I look around me and I see so much insanity. And I've never asked myself so many times in like a year, like, am I the crazy one? Like, I constantly ask myself that because I see people with PhDs that are saying that, like, you know, like Sally Hines in the UK, who will say that, you know, the female skeleton didn't exist until the Enlightenment. It's like, what are you talking about here?
Wait, what?
What does that even mean?
Huh?
and they're saying with a straight face to their hundreds of thousands of followers.
What's that even supposed to mean?
I have no idea. It's, I don't know. I mean, you'll get them saying that, you know, sex was constructed by Enlightenment thinkers, that these weren't categories that people even identified before then. They were just socially constructed out of some weird background, but it's complete madness. Like, we weren't able to tell males and females, you know, before the Enlightenment, like when people were having children and people were know, we obviously could correlate the fact that people who, you know, had vaginas or like innies or whatever, like they had the children and they tended to behave more similarly this way. It's completely mad.
It's weird. It's like a lot of these ideas, I feel like they're so stupid that only pretty smart people could have concocted them.
Yeah.
Right. See, when I hear some of these ideas, like, yeah, it's like if you talk to, I don't know, just a completely average intelligence or even sort of, you know, slightly below average intelligence person, right? In some ways, it's almost like they're smarter than some of the people who are pushing this stuff because it's like, okay, they don't have all this education. They might not have the degrees or the but they exist in reality. So
it seems like, it seems like there's this threshold that you'll reach in certain fields that, you know, not so much, I'd say the harder sciences, but in more of the social sciences, you'll get so far from reality. So like you obviously, like in the sciences, if your experiment doesn't work, then it's not real. Like you didn't need, the result's not there. Like you're going to be constantly checked by reality. If you do a physics experiment and you predict the light's going to bend a certain way and it bends the opposite way, like, well, your hypothesis was wrong, back to the drawing board. But a lot of these other fields, they might start, you know, early on from a place where they're, you know, actually maybe gathering data on humans and personalities and relating it to things. But there becomes sort of this point, this threshold that they go through where they sort of leave empiricism behind and they just enter into a world that's nothing but theory, with a capital T. And then they'll just get so involved in the theory that this then is how it becomes a lens with how they then look back and observe reality. And when they see that, you know, the equivalent of the light bending the other way, they don't, instead of saying that, like, maybe my theory is wrong, they just, like, a lot of times their theory will have this circular component in it where, like, it reinforces the theory itself.
The light, you know, is racist.
Yeah, you'll get, like, white, yeah. So for instance, you'll get, like, white fragility theory, Robin DiAngelo. And this has a built-in function where, like, white fragility is, if you question white fragility, if you're skeptical of it, if you get angry when someone like does it, like, that's just more evidence of it. You know, it's like this Kafka trap where it's just like, it's a theory with a closed loop that you just can't, you can never get out. And then you just keep going faster and faster through this loop, the more you drill down. And this is not how knowledge is produced. If you can't have any way to falsify your theory. And in fact, any attempt to falsify it is now evidence for its validation. This is not knowledge. This is completely just separate entirely from knowledge. It's not another way of knowing. It's just wrong.
Yeah. I mean, do you really think these people have good intentions? Because that's something that I initially thought a few years ago, but I'm really starting to doubt that idea that lots of this stuff is stemming from good intentions, because some of it is going so far that I'm like, no one in their right mind who's genuinely a kind and compassionate person who kind of wants the best for everybody, I don't think you'd be pushing some of these ideas. I mean, taking a really obvious one, of course, I had my deadlift video, which went viral a few months ago, where obviously, I stepped up and broke the women's British record to make a point. But, you know, taking something like that, like having biologically male athletes competing against biological females, technically men competing against women in sport, especially if you're talking about a contact sport or you're talking, you know, something like, I don't know, boxing, rugby, American football, you know, MMA. I mean, anyone, it just seems like anyone with the right, just any normal person would just go, no, like, no, that's not fair. You know, you don't need to be a scientist. We all know, like, society forever has known that on average, men are physically bigger, stronger, faster than women. It's the reason you separate the sports to begin with. Yes. So it strikes me as alarming that, you know, you've got people kind of allowing this to happen or pushing for it to happen under the guise of compassion or inclusivity or fairness. And I mean, it's the complete opposite. You're having the whole wax my balls. the whole ball waxing thing where you've got, you know, a biological man claiming to be a woman and going around and shutting down female-run businesses for refusing to wax their male genitals. I mean, it almost sounds like a parody, right? Like if you told someone about this 10 years ago, you'd be like, dude, what are you talking about? You go back to 2009 and say, okay, man, in 2019, this is what's everyone be like, dude, come on, like, come off it. So
it's a South Park episode at this point.
So that's why I'm started. That's why I think I'm like, no, these people don't have good intentions. Like, you can't have good intentions and be wanting some of these things to happen. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me anymore.
I think at least most of them do and have good intentions. I have a lot of pretty far left friends that I interact with on Facebook. I tend not to post on Facebook too much anymore because when I have, I've lost like long-term friends that I've had since kindergarten because of me speaking out on this stuff. And I don't want to, you know, lose some of these old friends in that way. So
that in itself doesn't, I mean, I don't want to diss your friends at all. That in itself doesn't strike me as the way, like, again, someone who claims to be tolerant, kind and compassionate and whatnot.
I still have a lot that haven't disowned me as a friend. And I know that I've known them for a long time, and I know that they're good, compassionate people. Okay. I do think there are people that are just leeching off of these movements to, you know, for virtue signaling purposes or whatever. Like, I think it's unclear whether Jessica Yaniv ball waxer person is being honest, and I don't think they care. I think they're just narcissistic and they're just trying to get anything they can out of it in general. But I do think most of the people, I try not to assume people's motives, but I think a lot of them do have compassion. I think it's just this idea of intersectionality is sort of where things go haywire. Because when you were constructing these hierarchies of oppression, trans people are in this hierarchy are beneath that of biological women. And so to them, it doesn't matter that they could potentially destroy female sports or what they would say women's sports, and women's sports need to have women and trans women are women. You know, they go down that whole pathway. Yeah, I don't understand how they, cause I have had like a discussion with someone on Facebook. And they were just trying to say that, you know, like, well, no, the number one predictor of athletic ability is, you know, coaches growing up. And if you have the best coaches, and I'm just trying to instill to them, like, well, no, good coaching might be a really good predictor within each sex, but certainly not between the sexes. Like, no amount of coaching is going to make a better athlete of this, you know, mediocre female compared to. A decent male athlete.
The weirdest thing with the sport one as well, though, is that there's not even an overlap. If you take the top tier athletes of almost any sport, barring maybe like two or three exceptions, like long distance swimming and gymnastics, maybe, you know, certain types of gymnastics or ballroom dancing or ice skating, right? Mm-hmm. Like the top 10,000 people, not even the top 100, right? The top 10,000, maybe the top 50,000. In, I don't know, say sprinting, weightlifting, you know, any throwing event, any swimming, like they're all men. It's not like there's an overlap and we're not quite sure how much. That's the thing that strikes me as just so bizarre. I mean, you could take the 50,000th, I don't have data on this, but I imagine you could take the 50,000th fastest man in the world. And you might be, maybe 50,000 is too much. I mean, it can change the numbers. The 10,000th fastest man in the world, I'd imagine, is faster than the fastest woman in the world, right? The 10,000th the 10,000th strongest man in the world is stronger than the strongest. And so that's the thing. It's not even like it's close. Like, it's so black and white.
Yeah, it's this failure to look, to appreciate just, I guess, the distribution of abilities. So a lot of these conversations that people have when they're arguing that we should be, you know, blowing up the women, male and female sports, and everyone should just compete, you know, in one big league that you somehow hear a lot now, they're confusing, you know, the overlap that exists at sort of the center of the distributions. So like, everyone knows, like, I know women who are faster than men. I know women who are faster than most men that I know.
Yeah, of course.
Extremely great athletes. And so, but they're looking sort of around that area of substantial overlap. Mm. But yeah, but they don't tend to care that, like, okay, no, well, if we're talking about professional sports, we're not talking about this middle area of the overlap. We're talking about the extreme tail ends of this distribution. And if so, any, even if like the differences in means were very small, which they're not in a lot of these sports, but even if they were, you still have, I mean, small differences in the mean can still turn into huge differences in representation at the extremes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you get this for like height in basketball players and, you know, how fast you can throw. Basically, almost any metric that you want to measure athletic performance on, you're going to have an overrepresentation of males at the extreme.
Yeah.
You know, and if everything were then just to be, I've heard people say that they want to, you know, all sports should maybe just be by weight classes.
Mm.
And then, well, if you did that, well, there's still a lot of overlap between males and females in weight. So the only weight classes that you would see females maybe competing in would be like the most absolute lightest, like 50 pounds or less. And then like who, I mean, I guess I'd watch that, but, but it would just be like, it'd be males dominating every single weight class except for the very, very lightest. And even then there might just, you might even have a male that just sneaks under there and will outlift them or outrun them or something.
Well, one thing I just learned the other day, I think this is true. One of my Twitter followers was telling me, because I tweeted something in relation to this, which is that I don't know in the UK, but they were actually saying in all the big leagues in America, they're not even sort of like, you know, the NBA, the NHL, the MLB, all of that. They're not actually formally male leagues.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
There's no rule in there saying that women aren't allowed.
They're open.
It's just that obviously if you take all the best, I mean, that in itself, to someone who's there saying, oh, I don't know, you know, I know, you know, maybe that one woman, like, that's just like, no, like.
You'll hear the argument that people will say that, you know, well, females come in all shapes and sizes, just like males do. So, you know, we need to get rid of these male and female categories. So I tweeted out once that says like something along the lines of, you know, if females come in all shapes and sizes, quote unquote, then why isn't there, how come none has ever been of the shape or size that has been able to compete in MLB, NBA, NHL? It's like, there's nothing barring them from going in these leagues. Like if they can make the team, they can. And of course there's not like sexism from these leagues. If there were some woman out there who's shooting threes like Steph Curry, like they would get hired instantly. Like all they care about is winning. They're not gonna care about whether or not it's a female on the team.
No.
So it's madness. What,
so where do you think this all goes, man?
Yeah. So it's getting more insane right now, and I think there's gonna be. So I've sort of likened it to sort of like a predator prey dynamic system where this sort of self-ID ideology, if you think of them as sort of like a rabbit population. So they're beginning to spike now. They're going crazy. It's reaching peak, you know, peak trans, what people call it now. But then if you look at how the prey how the predator population responds to like these increase in these prey populations, it's never coincident with the spike in prey. It's always the prey are going to go up first, and then the predators are responding to the prey population. So the predator population will then spike, you know, a slightly lag time after the prey spike. And so I think that's kind of what we're seeing now. I think the prey being the gender ideology, that's beginning to spike right now. But I think the ideology is sort of like a vampire in the sense that when it's exposed to light, it's going to go away. And I think the Jessica Yaniv situation, getting, I think the Olympics, when we have more male athletes competing as females, that'll shine a bunch of light on this ideology. We're seeing it in high school athletes now where, you know, trans girls or, you know, biological males who aren't even required to take any hormones whatsoever are competing in the smashing state records in the female category. And the vast majority of people think this is absurd. Like, if you were to just poll anyone, and I mean, well over 90% just clearly don't want this to happen. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people are just working. They're not paying attention to the intricacies of what's going on in the gender debates and gender ideology and self ID. But they're going to be forced to pretty soon if we have these Yaniv cases in the Olympics. And so once these things are exposed, I think that the prey population, which I see as, you know, you, me, and other people who are objecting to this, that's going to follow very shortly after. So I can't imagine it getting crazier than it is now, but I said that several months ago and it seems like, so.
The thing is as well, though, is I think there's going to be that challenge of rolling things back because people never like to roll things back, right? So if they sort of create a law or a rule or an allowance, which then allows, I don't know, allows certain people to compete in certain ways and whatever, then they're going to have a lot of issues just kind of drawing a hard line in the sand and going, oh, okay, look, we messed up. We're going to repeal this because that's when people are going to, you know, I don't think most people, right? But certain people are going to kick off. Like, what's always, that's always the case, isn't it? Once you allow something, it becomes really hard to disallow it. And it seems like, you know, they've just been giving in and giving in and giving in. And I don't know. I mean, my personal idea is I think we should sort of have a day where we all identify as women, as I did previously. And we all just, you know.
Exactly.
Right. I think we just take it to its logical end conclusion, like really fast. Just a bunch of guys, I don't know, just go invade female changing rooms, female sports, female. Just have a bunch of guys
just
in there.
Just a day of identification.
Exactly. Just push it to its logical thing. I think Donald Trump should identify as a woman and become the first. become the first female American president. Cause, dude, that'll be the checkmate. Surely that's the checkmate.
Because if trans women are women, then if Donald Trump identifies, I mean, you can't say that he's not.
Just grow the blonde hair out a little bit, get the orange tan going. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous what's going on. And the scariest part is that a lot of these changes to laws, you know, of like replacing sex related laws, like laws that acknowledge sex, like Title IX laws, and you know, the other. Any of the laws on the books for who gets access to certain spaces and receives certain funds. These have, in places like Canada, so a lot of these laws that were looking at sex before are now replaced with gender ID, but these laws haven't been changed by any sort of vote among the population. Mm-hmm. They've just been sort of changed as a sort of an admin thing at the top. The government officials just, you know, somehow just like changing the wording here from sex to gender ID. But they don't realize the enormous just like downstream effects that this has, where maybe it's a good idea that we had a bunch of these laws that reflected biological sex and not gender ID. You know, like when we maybe these were there for a reason, and by just completely unearthing that, just getting rid of the actual material basis of these laws, these are going to have huge ramifications. There's these trophic cascades that are going to happen, these downstream effects. And we're seeing these right now in the Yaniv case and in the Olympics and different sporting events. And
wasn't there one as well where a man who had sexually assaulted some women, who was in prison for sexual assault, identified as a woman and got transferred to an all-female prison and then proceeded to sexually assault. I mean,
fox in the hen house scenario there.
Big when time. I hear that kind of stuff, like my jaw just drops. I'm just it's like.
You need an adult, like someone has to be the adult in the room and just be like, hold their arm and just be like, this is insane. Like,
terrible idea. This is literally the worst idea anybody has ever come up with. No, right? People just need to be able to say no.
There's no adult. It's just you have the first graders who are in charge of like the kindergarten class now. And
it is weird, man. It is weird. I don't know. It's something I've ended up talking about quite a few times on the podcast, weirdly, just because like especially the kind of people I talk to on the podcast, right? I try to talk to people who haven't been brainwashed, by certain ideology, and everyone's just, you know, very clearly this thing's not right. It's not going to end well. Like,
yeah, I'm optimistic. I think where the pushback is mounting, we might still get a little crazier before it starts to get better. But I do think that the force of sort of the gender identity politics, I think they are receiving some pushback. It's just going to take a little bit longer before that pushback is actually going to be strong enough to actually turn it back the other direction. But I think it's mounting. I really hope it's not crazier in 10 years, but it could be. But I think
hey,
in the next 10 years, I think a lot will revert, hopefully back to somewhat normal, but not completely.
I filled out a form. I filled out a form a couple of weeks ago, and I was able to self-identify my race.
Oh, really?
Yeah, race and ethnicity. It was So there was gender, and then there was race/ethnicity, and it had a little it had an asterisk, and then at the bottom it had a little bit of an explanation. So for gender, it had gender is not necessarily biological sex, but it's whatever you choose to identify as. And then I had like a few different examples. And it had the same thing for race and ethnicity. And I'd never seen that on a form before. Like, this is like a proper professional form, right? And so it had race and ethnicity. No, yeah, ethnicity is not necessarily tied to skin color or nationality, but it's whatever you identify. So I could have identified as a Native American woman. Right. Yeah. You're hearing
go
about
on the website and look at how many grants are available for.
Yeah.
But I mean, just identifying to that group.
Yeah. I found that really interesting because that was I've seen it for gender before. But that was the first time I'd seen it for race and ethnicity. And I was just like, this is really interesting. this is really interesting here.
It's another area where people use the univariate fallacy as well, is trying to say that there are just like no differences in populations. Even in the way people, look in anything for different races at all. Like they try to say that these are just all social constructs as well. Yeah. And they fail to take into account that it's the correlations among, genes that are inherited together that create like sort of the, what we call like a family resemblance that we have, like if you have a family, you kind of look like your dad, and your brothers and sisters all look alike.
Yeah, yeah.
You might not be able to say what is the one feature that makes us a family, like that, just by the way that we look, but it's a bunch of different correlated traits. Like you have, a similar nose structure, you have the similar eyes or something, and you can see this family resemblance. And then when you were talking about races or something, or ancestral populations, that's just a family resemblance on a population level.
Yeah, yeah.
But now they're trying to debunk that by saying that, like there's not a single gene that you can't find in one population or another, which isn't completely true, but yeah, so it's the univariate fallacy comes back and just feeds into all these narratives about getting rid of binaries or destructing categories.
The interesting thing with that is there's a much better argument that one is much more of a spectrum.
Yeah,
so
it is more of one, yeah.
So that's the problem. It's like, well, if that one is a spectrum, then by that same logic, I mean, race, ethnicity, skin color, whatever word term someone, I mean, that one definitely is a spectrum because you can take some... You've got people who are like super pale, down, albino, and then you've got the darkest skinned person, and you literally do have people of every single shade in there. And if you take someone from there and someone from there, and they have children, then the children are going to be somewhere around the halfway between them.
Yeah, exactly.
So in that one, it's like, I don't know. And then of course you've got the what about age, right? I've heard people talking about trans age.
There's trans deaf people now too. I just saw
deaf.
People identifying as being deaf.
Wow.
And there was someone pushing back saying like, you guys aren't really deaf. Like, I don't know if they're actually like impairing their ears on purpose, but it was, it's hard to say if it was parody or not. I don't think it was. It seemed pretty sincere that there's people who are self-identifying into the deaf community now.
Wow. That is so weird. That is so weird. The thing is, it's also, I'd imagine if you were actually deaf and that was something that you, have struggled with or had to deal with in your life, then that would actually be genuinely offensive.
Yeah.
I mean? Like that would be genuinely, you're like, okay, no, I actually can't hear.
Yeah.
And you're here being able to hear, pretending that you can.
Yeah. I said that I identify as deaf fluid, that I either hear or don't hear depending on my opinion of you or how much I like you.
Man, that's funny, man. So what have you got coming up next, Colin? You said you're applying for various jobs. Do you have any other projects or writing or anything else that you're working on?
Yeah, I'm currently writing an essay length version of sort of my univariate fallacy thread. I have a collaborator on there. I'm not going to say who that is right now, but it's probably someone you follow on Twitter. That should be coming out hopefully in the next week or two. I've just gotten back from the field recently, so I've just been settling in and getting ready to sort of get more experiments going in the lab. So I'm trying to find time to just like dedicate to writing this thing. Mm-hmm. So hopefully you'll see that come out in the relatively near future.
Okay.
But other than that, it's just job applications, and I'm making rum actually for the first time ever. So I'll be doing that pretty soon.
You're making rum.
I am. Yeah, it's okay. A new hobby.
That's not what I'm seeing in the background, is it?
Nope. It's over there on the other side.
Oh, okay. Okay. Awesome, man. Well, I wish you good luck with that. Where's the article going to be published?
So we've reached out to Quillette, and they seem like they're receptive to taking it, but there's no guarantee that it's going to go there. But that's where we're shooting for. And I'd say it has a good shot of going there. We've talked to Claire Lehman, and she seems like she's open to having that submitted there. So
okay,
we'll see. I'll let you know when that gets out.
Yeah, wherever it happens to
be.
And last for the listeners, where can they follow you online if they want to check out more of your thoughts and your words?
So you can follow me on Twitter at Swipe Right. So WRIGHT. And that's basically where you'll find me.
Awesome. Colin Wright, thank you for joining us on the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Zuby.
Take care.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.